Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. We will be discussing Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. This week I'm joined by Helen.
Hello.
Harry.
Hello.
And Jake.
Hello.
We also have a special guest awaiting you today, the film's creative source, Tarell Alvin McCraney. But before we get on to our discussion of the film and the interview, let's have a question. So, Moonlight chronicles the life of a young gay black man from childhood to adulthood as he struggles to find his place in the world, growing up in a rough neighbourhood in Miami. So, where the film's told in three chapters, Chiron as a young boy, a teenager, and an adult. So I'd like you three to pitch a film to me with three actors or actresses playing the same character from a young age, a sort of middle part of their life, and an older age. We'll start with Jake.
Okay, I think the rules were established that we don't really need a story, we just need the three people. And we'll find it along the way.
Yeah, that's fine.
In the true traditional filmmaking.
Jake has not won the point.
we'll find it in... Yeah. Wait. All right.
You just cut your point in half, Jake, but
okay.
Go on.
Wait, okay, the young chapter, the first third, the aliens from Toy Story.
Wow.
Okay, so that's where we're starting. Chapter two, Kang and Kodos from The Simpsons.
Got you.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Yep. Chapter 3, Abbott and Costello from Arrival.
Wow.
All right. So we start with, and notice, the number of eyes that they have reduces, all right? But their awareness grows. Yeah? So they start with three eyes in Aliens, as the aliens in Toy
silence.
Story. And then they've only got one each in as Kang and Kodos. So what's happened there? You know, what have they seen? What have they gone through? To then and then
to
in
take
a,
to take one of their eyes away.
Two.
Well, no,
two
no.
Two of their
they've
eyes,
merged then. Into just one big eye.
What? So you think they? So you think
like this spans millennia? Like,
oh, okay.
This story could do. And then when we reach their development to the ones in Arrival, they've got no eyes. So, I mean, there's room for a lot of story here. What has happened to go from, you have saved their lives, we are totally grateful, to then be the aliens way in the future of Arrival, where they come back and they save the humans' lives and they're eternally grateful.
What? Would you have it like a Simpsons cartoon? Or would you have it like Toy Story? Or would you have it set in the real... Like, how... Or would you merge each...
Harry, I'm not a slave to form, you know? I'm a slave to story. All right.
That's what they say about you.
Yeah. And coming, because Kang and Kodos, they hate the humans. So in the first act, they love them because the humans saved them. And then in the third act, they go to save the humans again. But in the middle of it, they're trying to destroy them. So what has happened, you know, over that time? And that's what we're going to figure out. And so that's my film.
Good.
My idea, what I've done is I've actually put the actors I've chosen into a film rather than just trying to get everyone else to do the work for me, because I know some people have done that.
Mate, I'm going to do Mike Lee with mine. Like, I'm going to stick him in a village hall, going to put tape marks on the floor, and just like, guys, we'll figure it out. We'll Vera Drake this thing.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, so my idea is I want to do a three-part Joker film. as in Joker from the Batman.
Good.
Because I feel like the Joker's feeling a bit neglected at the moment.
Yep.
Suicide Squad wasn't the strongest. Let's all be honest about that. Since Heath Ledger, we haven't had a strong Joker.
You haven't seen Lego Batman yet?
I haven't seen that yet, so I can't comment. But a human Joker, then.
Okay.
So, we're starting with, why has he become who he's become? Will Poulter, the young British actor, is going to play the Joker.
I think he's got a good smile for the Joker.
Right.
And then this is a bit redemption for myself for previous comments. Vince Vaughn is going to play the sort of middle-aged Joker.
Yeah.
Because I last
what?
Time, I think last time I wasn't very nice about him. So when we did the Tony Erdman one, so yeah, he's going to play the middle one, but like sort of Joker, like. He's evil. He's vicious.
Right. The Joker's going to be evil. What?
He's put on a bit of weight.
You really hate Vince Vaughn.
He's walking through a desert, barefoot. He's looking at mould on his ceiling.
He's playing dodgeball.
I really don't like Vince Vaughn. And then, redemption Joker just got out of prison, been let out because he's dying and he wants to redeem some of the bad things he's done. Jeff Bridges.
Oh, right.
As an old Joker. And then sort of that lovely... But just sort of three scenes rather than a sort of biopic going through everything. Much like sort of Steve Jobs or something like that, the way that was done. So three particular moments, but Poulter in the first one, Vince Vaughn in the second one, and Jeff Bridges in the third one.
Helen.
Right. If you're playing along at home, I need you to open Google... And then I need you to open Microsoft Paint.
Right.
Right. First up, Alex Lawther, who I noticed in the Imitation Game, he plays a young Alan Turing, and then he's in the third episode of Black Mirror. Can we all agree that he's a brilliant actor?
I think he has come up on this podcast from you about four or five times
now. Yeah, because he's incredible, and he's going to do incredible things.
Yeah.
So he's the young. Then the middle, Paul Dano.
Yeah.
Who is in Swiss Army Man and is the mute kid in Little Miss Sunshine.
Yep.
Okay. The last, Julian Barrett, Mighty Boosh.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, now you've all got them on Microsoft Paint, I need you to highlight their eyes. Similar theme to you, Jake, we could combine.
Yeah.
Highlight their eyes. I've really pulled it out the back. They've basically got the same eyes, but they just get smaller. So this is a film about a man.
Don't say it.
Who is convinced his eyes are getting smaller, but nobody else in the film seems to notice. And he suddenly realises that maybe no one's ever looked at him.
Okay.
You've lost your mind, haven't you, Helen?
And this needs to be the story of an entire life.
I'm crying with joy.
Yeah. Like, this is the 30-year story.
Yeah.
People can't see it, but Helen is sat back like she's just invented the wheel. But yep, nailed
that. Instead,
she's
broken cinema.
She's got. This is how I imagine Stanley Kubrick looked in the 2001 pitch. Like, guys, I've nailed it.
Smaller.
What else do you want me to say? Smaller eyes.
I think me, Sam, and Jake could do that because Sam's got quite big eyes.
Yeah.
And then I've got like sort of small. But you can barely see Jake.
Jake's
got no eyes. So we could play that movie.
I often just like hold Jake's arm and lead him around places, forgetting that he can see.
Guys, I do have eyes.
Who are you looking at?
Well, that's part of my mystery, isn't it? You know.
My pick is I'm going to do a Benjamin Button female remake.
Nice.
So Judi Dench
as the young one.
Judi Dench, Emma Stone, and the girl from The Nice Guys, Andrea.
Sorry, that's a huge jump. Judi Dench has got like 40 years.
Yeah, that's fine. We can make a big jump.
Benjamin Button, mate.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah,
it's Benjamin Button.
So we don't need to do the Brad Pitt thing where it's just the same person.
Yeah, it's Emma Stone. But, I mean, they aged Brad Pitt from, like, 19 to 60 in that film with CGI. So you could do the same with Emma Stone. Just keep her for the maid bulk. And then at the beginning, you have Dench.
Sorry, I find that so weird. What? I'm spending my whole film with Emma Stone aging, and then it's just,
aging backwards,
though. Yeah, I know. But then it's just, so we spent 2 hours with her, and there's like, oh, there's Judi Dench.
No, Judi Dench is at the beginning.
Sorry.
You're forgetting the
but
premise.
Still, yeah.
We start off with Dench.
Yeah.
She's doing her thing. Next scene, it's Emma Stone, who looks a little bit like Judi Dench. She gets less and less like Judi Dench, and then she's Emma Stone as we know her. Then she gets more and more like Andrew Rice. And then the next scene, she's Andrew Rice. Fincher did it. I can do it.
Oh, yeah. And you could use the technology from Looper that they used to kind of merge the faces.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, what, Benjamin Zipper? Or Benjamin Clasp?
Benjamina.
Yeah, Benjamina.
Please don't name your child
Benjamina. Sorry, I'm trying to come up with a title. That's half the work.
Benjamina Zipper.
Benjamina Zipper.
Inspired.
The curious, the odd life of Benjamina Zipper.
The odd existence of Benjamina Zipper.
That just sounds like it's got Tim Burton written all over it, doesn't it?
Quirky kids. Right. That was Danny Elfman. That was supposed to be Danny Elfman.
Nailed it.
Yeah. All right. Let's have a winner then. What do we think? I mean, I think Small Eyes got a good reaction.
Oh, come on.
I personally quite liked The Aliens, but...
So lie, but I think he should have gone for it rather than be like, oh, this is what I'm doing.
Wait, what? I'm going to do it. It's going to be like a link letter thing. We find it along the way, you know?
I think you should have found it before the podcast.
Do you think that's how Boyhood worked? No.
I'm going to be honest. It's no Boyhood.
It could be. Alienhood. That's going to be Noel Clarke's next film.
Oh. That's the fourth in the saga. All right, should we have a vote? Who votes for the aliens?
I'll go Alien.
Alien. Aliens has won.
Yes!
Harry didn't vote. Jake didn't vote.
Disgrace. I was going to vote for her.
Yeah, but I can just vote for whatever Harry doesn't.
What, I think we should. Right, okay.
I'm going to put my hand. I'm going to say Smaller Eyes. I like
right,
smaller.
So it's a draw.
So it's a draw. So you get half a point each.
It's and we a said tie.
That we both have the thing about the eyes. Let's combine plots.
Let's
We've
do
got
it.
This. There we are. We both win.
Okay. So we're about to discuss Moonlight, but before that, we have an interview now. So before it was Moonlight, the film started as a small treatment written by acclaimed playwright Tyrell Alvin McCraney, titled In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, about his life growing up in Liberty City, Miami. I sat down with McCraney earlier this week in London and spoke to him about his childhood, the origins of the film, and his previous work under August Wilson. So enjoy.
Okay, and we're delighted to be joined by Tyrell Alvin McCraney. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So congratulations on the film and its incredible reaction and reception and all the awards it's been nominated for. But something that's kind of caught my attention is that so last weekend at the BAFTAs it was nominated for Best Original Screenplay and then at the Oscars it's Best Adapted Screenplay. Mm-hmm. So could you maybe sort of... explain the origins of the film and maybe give some context to that sort of discrepancy in the awards and how it's recognised?
Well, sure. I mean, I'll deal with the easiest first, yeah. Which is the discrepancy, quote unquote. The Academies, both BAFTA and the Academy Awards, are private institutions, and so they have certain scriptures that they or precepts that they place on these categories. And,
yeah.
You know, in one place we fit the bill in one way, in another place we fit in the total opposite. So, to me, it's it's their party. So we sort of just show up and say thank you, either way, and so that's how that works.
Yeah.
The way in which the script became Moonlight is a little bit of a complicated story, which I don't mind telling it. It feels so it's stranger than fiction. Actually, it's I wrote In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue as a kind of filmic meditation on my life in Liberty City. My mother just died from AIDS-related complications. I just graduated from undergrad. And I kind of didn't know where my life was going. And I was really terrified that I wasn't going to be able to put some very strong memories together.
Yeah.
Again, you know, you forget things, but you often think, okay, well, my mom or my dad will remember it for me.
Yeah.
And so with her gone, I felt like, wow, there was going to be so much that I just didn't retain. So I just really eagerly wanted to put things down and wrestle with this question of, you know, who were the most important people to me and my quote-unquote role models, and who, what I was looking at a life as a performer, as an artist, as an actor at the time. But, you know, why didn't I become a drug dealer?
Mm-hmm.
One of the most influential people in my life, especially from a young age, was a drug dealer. And, you know, what would my life look like if I had gone down that road, which was an invitation that I had gotten often growing up in Liberty City? So I put those, I put that down and put it down in like 60 or 70 pages or less. And then tried to move on with my life and continue writing plays. And so I had this script called Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And my friend Andrew Hevia, who is a co-producer of Moonlight the film, but also he runs a company called Borscht Film Festival Film Company in Miami, which is dedicated to like getting Miami artists to create films. They were working with Barry Jenkins. And Barry had created this film called Medicine for Melancholy in San Francisco. And they were like, well, look, how do we get you to create something as beautiful as medicine in Miami? Because you're from Miami, you were born and raised there. Now, I had never met Barry, and I didn't know really who he was. I knew of his work. And then Andrew gave Barry in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And then that's how we began to have a conversation about growing up blocks away from each other, living literally in the same neighborhood, both having mothers who struggled with addiction, which is, you know, which was in the piece.
Yeah.
Barry took that script and then rewrote it specifically to shoot Moonlight, and that's how we got here.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned the word there, like meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see writing the play and the film as a kind of, sort of therapeutic or kind of cathartic and sort of exploring your past life in a way?
I wish it felt like a cathartic feeling. It does feel like exercising in that you are doing something about the ephemeral.
Okay.
You're doing something physical that is about things that are intangible. However, you know, at the end of it, you think of catharsis and you think, something's gotten out.
Yeah.
And that's not how this feels. It feels like I've gotten something down.
Right.
It feels like I've been able to pin down a ghost or an apparition that had been floating around. And we finally got a photograph of it. So there's proof, right, that it exists. There's something meditative about that. But does it give you a sort of peace? I don't know.
Okay. There's still things to work on, I guess. And
always, yeah. There's always something to work on.
And how was it giving something so personal to you to someone else? Like, to say, look, take this, do what you want with it, kind of in a way. I mean, is that kind of difficult?
You know, in two parts is the answer to that question. Because in the original conference or conversation between Barry and I, it wasn't very difficult because Barry has and had a lexicon, even without, I mean, again, I didn't know all of the things that we shared right off the bat. But because of the way he talked about the piece in such a very direct and poignant way, and again, if he grew up in that neighborhood and during that time, there was no way, and possessing the talents that he had, there was no way he couldn't bring, you know, the kind of verisimilitude and quality to it that it just, you couldn't, it's impossible. Right. It's so specific, you know, it's so Miami in that way. And so I had there was no doubt in my mind that he knew that world and understood it.
Yeah.
You know, he kept inviting me to set. And in that place, I didn't trust myself. And not because I thought he or the actors wouldn't do justice to the script, but when something's that personal and you see it happening again, you can't help but just want to get involved and sort of make it so. And then, and also the actors and maybe even Barry would have been looking to me to kind of verify and check off like, oh yeah, that's how it went.
Yeah.
And that's not important at that moment.
Yeah.
In that moment, what's more important is that they're bringing their most true selves to it, which is why we have such an incredible, beautiful film.
Yeah.
That, you know, these artists really knew what they were doing, down to the cinematographer, up to the grips. I mean, these are people who are professionals and deserve all the sort of accolades they got because they did the work. And they didn't just sort of, you know, turn around and go, hey, is this exactly like it was? And so for me, the trust came in going, knowing myself well enough to go, that it's too personal to watch these scenes be played out. Stay the F home, you know, and let them do their job.
And I understand they filmed in Liberty City itself. Mm. And so you said then that you kind of tried to stay away from that as much as you could?
Yeah, I stayed away. Yeah. There was no try. I stayed away.
You weren't on set at all, really?
No. I went to Barry's office maybe two or three times, and they were literally around the corner from my house.
Okay.
So I would go around there and say, hey, how you doing? And anything I can do? Or, you know, they had a casting call once, or they had a location problem at some point and they needed an elementary school. So I called, you know, people that I knew and sort of got them set up in ways that I could. But, you know, it was better that I was not on anybody's set.
So if the film had been given to someone, a director who hadn't, you know, hadn't had Barry's background or a similar background to you, would you have been even more hesitant?
It just wouldn't have happened.
Okay.
I mean, there were directors who came in before, and friends of mine who came in before who wanted to, you know, produce it, and they would say things like, "Let's do it in Chicago," or, you know, "We can totally, you know, we can extend this into a revenge film or something like that."
Yeah.
And you know, my answer was always, "No, that's okay. You know, I'm busy. I have other things to do. But thank you."
Yeah.
You know, and so the reason it became easy and the reason it happened was because when Barry said those things, it all made sense and there was like an easy yes.
Yeah.
You know, a quick and easy yes. There was no need to have to go, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know,
it's a sure thing.
Yeah. I mean, it just made sense. It just made a qualitative sense that didn't take long to think about. Whereas there have been times when people had brought suggestions for it before and I was just like, this isn't right.
So having seen the film now, and I assume you spent time with the actors, and in that sense, is it strange being around some of them? Like Marshall Ali, for example, because he plays the basis of the drug dealer that you knew growing up.
Yep.
Is it weird being around him every now and then?
It's not weird being around him. I do remember the first time I saw the film and I was with him, you know, I sort of started crying and he had to kind of pick me up. And I think that, and in that moment, I just was really grateful to him.
Yeah.
As I am to Naomi Harris, as I am to, you know, Trevante and Andre Holland, who is a dear friend of mine and, you know, has been in every one of my plays. They just, to be able to find people who, and again, I don't know if you know the budget of the film, but it's not like we know, they're not paying these actors a whole great deal of money and, you know, we're not putting them up at the Ritz-Carlton when they're down there. You were just literally taking time off of, you know, Bond films and you know, Netflix smash hits and to come down and make this piece of poetry. But with such skill, that's the thing that I can't get over. None of them shirked on it because, you know, it was a lower end budget. Yeah. None of them shirked on the amount of talent that they brought forward. And even Barry, you know, Barry could have easily been like, oh, you know, this is a little thing that we're making.
Yeah.
Put his full self in it.
Sure.
Same with James, same with Adela. I mean, A24, they sort of just brought as much of themselves to it as possible. And I think, you know, you can't be anything but grateful to something like that.
I know you weren't on set, but how were the people of Liberty City with this film going on? Were they okay with it, or were they helpful?
I mean, there was a trepidation in the beginning, I think, from the neighborhood, and not because of the film's subject matter, but because more often than not, when someone comes to film inside Liberty City, they're doing either a newsreel about the violence or the poverty, or they're doing a TV show called First 48 or Cops.
Right.
Which takes place normally in, you know, poor neighborhoods, and you see cameras chasing after a police who is chasing after somebody who is, you know, committed a crime. And so after a while, you get tired of people just showing that about your neighborhood. But eventually, you know, Barry really worked to become, you know, back ingrained into the neighborhood that he'd grown up in, that we'd grown up in. And eventually, you know, people, I remember we walked there the other day because we were just, you know, taking pictures in general. Walking by my aunt's house, and someone, you know, my cousin rode by, and he was like, "Hey, you're in the neighborhood. Come by the house." And I was like, yeah, I'll be back there soon. He's like, yeah, what are y'all doing? You shooting Moonlight 2? And I was like, no, we're not shooting Moonlight 2. But it was just one of those moments where, like, the neighborhood has gotten to a point where they're like, this is our thing now.
Yeah.
So, you know, my cousin's going to tell me to come by the house in the middle of a shoot because, like, he doesn't care. He's like, yeah. I don't care if you're shooting. You need to come by the house and say hi. And then, two, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, well, you must be doing the sequel to Moonlight. Because, you know, we know you shot here, and it's just ingrained now. So I think they're pretty proud of it.
Yeah, a sense of pride in the community.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. And I mean, over the past few years, the conversation about representations of black experience in film, the gay experience in film, have become more and more important as, you know, people are just seeing it's an underrepresented experience in film. And do you think the reception Moonlight's had is a sign of moving forward? Progression in a way?
We can only hope. Yeah. I mean, I'm always sort of trepidatious in terms of figuring out waves of things. I think it's important that when we talk about representation, that we can't have flash in the pan moments.
Yeah.
Right? Because, for example, I was sort of sitting here or earlier, I think, figuring out how I've seen so many films about coming of age. I think there's a film called My Brother the Devil.
Right.
Which deals with, you know, a Muslim family and a young man who's struggling with his sexuality who was in gangs in East London, I think. Yeah. And it's just sort of a beautiful film, but that I've seen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but I don't know if a lot of other people have seen it. And so these sort of lulls that happen in terms of identity, people's identity in terms of color, in terms of poverty, in terms of sexuality, happen, and it's weird to me. And if Moonlight can help us not have those lulls, that's great. But I don't. It certainly wasn't created to to patch that up. It
to
was
avoid tokenism.
Yeah, it was created to tell a very intimate story about, you know, two young men's life in this community. But I, you know, you can always hope. You sort of hope that, okay, great, somebody will also tell a story of a young girl, you know, struggling to figure out her life in, you know, abject poverty in some other part of the world, and that will, you know, it'll have, and that it'll have a platform, hopefully, because, you know, we see now that people are eager and or at least hungry to see those stories.
Yeah, and obviously you're from a theater background. Mm. Would you like to do Moonlight as a produced play? On stage? No,
mm-mm.
It's done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Often, I mean, it never was ever going to be a play.
Right, okay.
It was always written. I mean, it's written so differently than anything I've ever written. It literally says interior, exterior,
right, okay.
And like, you know, I don't know how. I mean, I don't know how I would get anybody to do it. One and two, it's just so beautiful as a film. Why?
Yeah. Sure.
You know.
Okay. And so, what have you got planned next? What's next on your agenda?
Well, currently, I don't know if it's next, but concurrently as this is happening, I'm looking through applications for, you know, choosing the next class for my program at the drama school, so I'm reading lots of applications and, you know, reaching out to students in that way, sort of figuring out what our year together would be like, and then, that's taking a lot. That and talking about Moonlight is taking up a lot of my time.
Okay, and I understand you were sort of brought under the wing of August Wilson.
Mm.
I was wondering, have you seen Fences yet?
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
I think they did it a good job.
Oh yeah,
service.
Yeah. I mean, to share. I think, you know, it's interesting. It was really great to hear Denzel Washington talk about Barry and Barry Jenkins and the way he created that film. And I really loved that because that's one of the things that August was so great at. August was really great about looking at younger talent and sort of not even necessarily taking them under his wing, but just being an advocate, saying, hey, you should go see this person's work. They're a young artist, you know. And so the whole cast of Radio Golf, which was working at school where we were, he would just be like, oh, Terrell has a play. You should go see Terrell's play. And that was kind of incredible. I'll tell you a funny story that I don't often tell, which is that he brought me my first iPod.
Right, okay.
Did you know this?
I didn't know this, no.
All right, so I was his assistant, and I was a very bad assistant. I was not very good at all. Because I can't even assist my own life. Like, even now, I was like, I would be a terrible assistant.
Yeah.
But I was his assistant nonetheless, and he sort of called me up, and he said, hey, I need you to go buy my daughter.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
An iPod for her birthday. It's coming up and I need an iPod, one of those new fancy iPods. And I was like, well, I don't have iPods, so I don't know how that works. He's like, well, just go, I need you to go buy the best one. And so New Haven is like Oxford in that it's, you know, it's out somewhere in the, you know, and there's Oxford and then there's the Shire around it, but there's no like iPod store at this time. That the nearest Apple store was in New York City. So I would either have to get on a train or go to Best Buy. And I get in this car, and I drive all the way out to Orange, and I get, and I like, he gives me this wallet, this envelope full of like $100 bills. And I'm like, only old people do this. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and so I get this big pack of money, and I go out and I say, I need the most expensive warranty guaranteed iPod you have. Cause I'm pissed at this point. I'm missing class to go get this damn iPod. So I go get it. And I come back and I'm like, here's your iPod. And then I leave. I just give it to him and I go back to class because I'm late. And so he calls me back and he's like, I need you to sit down. So he sits down and he's like, okay, you always need music whenever you write. And he gives me the iPod. Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
He tricked me into buying my own iPod. And I'll never forget that. Because he, you know, he's just like that. He just, he always wants you to get to... To go, there's got to be a story towards it. There's got to be a journey towards it. Just can't be kind of there.
Yeah.
He always, you always with him. You needed to understand the journey. Andre Holland, who's in Moonlight, is in Jitney right now on Broadway, which is extraordinary. It's my favorite play, period. Okay. But also my favorite August Wilson play. And then Fences, I thought was extraordinary. I thought the performances in Fences were extraordinary.
Incredible story. Terrell, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. I'm sure I went way longer than I was supposed to.
The first thing he said to me when I walked in the room was, I like your socks.
Oh, nice.
You do have nice socks.
They were sort of, I described them as an aqua blue.
Oh, cool.
Were you only wearing socks?
I was only wearing socks. He had nothing else to say to me.
Yeah.
I like your socks.
Did you just turn and look at him and say, in sunlight, Sam's socks look blue.
Damn. You always think of these things when you leave, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was Terrell Alvin McCraney there. Right, so Moonlight. Moonlight is one of the major awards contenders this year. It's that and La La Land that are battling each other. Guys, do you think it's a worthy contender this year, Moonlight?
100%, yes.
Yep.
It should be. I think sadly it seems to be in other awards being a bit ignored. So, but I think it should be in terms of ensemble and it doesn't have one standout performance. And I think that's really to its credit. So I think it massively should be.
I think it's incredible. I think it's better than La La Land.
Okay. So before we get into it, let's just break down the plot. So as I said earlier, it's told in three chapters, three different stages of this boy Chiron's life. Jake, do you want to break down the cast list for us?
Yeah. So at the very start, we have Alex Hibbert as the young Chiron, who is nicknamed Little. Then we have Ashton Sanders as the teenager Chiron, who at that point is just Chiron. And then in the third chapter, we have Trevante Rhodes as the adult Charon, who is nicknamed Black.
Okay, and then we also have Naomi Harris as Charon's mother, who is the only actor to appear in all three parts of the film.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Janelle Monáe as a kind of sort of surrogate mother at points for him in the film.
Yeah, that's Teresa.
Yeah, and then Mahershala Ali as Juan, who is a drug dealer that sort of takes Charon under his wing in the first part of the film. Yeah. He's kind of been given the most attention for this, hasn't he?
Mahershala
Ali. Yeah, he's the one that's given the most sort of attention in the terms of the awards, and he's the favourite to win Best Supporting Actor. And he's the one that a lot of people have been talking about. But he's not in the film as much as I thought he'd be.
Yeah, yeah. I just quickly, we should also mention the actors that play Kevin.
Yeah. Kevin is a close friend of Charon's that runs through each thread of the story, and that's Jaden Piner, Jarrell Jerome, and Andre Holland play Kevin at the different stages of his life as they coincide with Charon as well. Going back to Mahershala Ali.
Yeah.
Who is excellent in this, and he's so warm in the role, but obviously so conflicted and complex when you realise what his job is. And it doesn't try and make that a big twist or anything. You know that from the start, but you just have that conflict and that complication from it immediately. But he is still so warm and compelling.
Barry Jenkins said in an interview that in most movies, a black drug dealer is just a black drug dealer, but he wanted to show that that's not the totality of who this character is. And I think that's a really strong point in the whole film. You've got the mother who is on drugs herself, but and Jenkins actually said that that was very personal for him because that reminded him of his own mother and his own experience. And Naomi Harris was not sure about taking that role, but sort of Jenkins promised her that he was going to make a full rounded character, and this is where the strength of the film is that every single character has such a story around them and has so many different parts of their own identity, and it's expressed so well without a narration as well, which I really wanted to mention because it reminded me a little bit of like Shawshank in some of the kind of identity and humanity and friendship themes, but it's so much braver than that because it doesn't have that narration over the top that's saying and then this happened and then this happened. It just lets the characters speak for themselves.
Yeah, it's not afraid of starving you of information.
Yeah.
It really, because it has those three chapters, there's nothing at the start of each one to get you up to speed. It drops you into that. Even the first scene is not Charon.
Yeah, the first person we see is Juan.
Yeah.
And we follow him for a good few minutes before we even know Charon exists, before he even enters the frame. So yeah, it does. It gives a lot of credit to the audience, and it really expects them and knows that they are smart enough, clever enough, and emotionally mature enough to get these characters without force feeding you any information about them. And I think that's quite—that's saying something in a film set in a very poor black neighborhood in this part of America that will often kind of really play these points to the max just to get them across. But this film, the information I think takes a backseat to the visuals and the characters, and that makes this a really nice experience to watch.
Yeah.
It's also something as well that took me a bit by surprise that it doesn't go for this kind of neo-realist approach to showing this community. At times, I found it quite sort of ephemeral and dreamlike. Did you get the same feeling?
Yeah, I think the excuse me. I think the music does that quite well. And actually, the music massively shows Charon's sort of inner feelings and actually what he's thinking. So it might be, there might be a drug deal going on somewhere, or his mum might be, on the sofa. But yeah, you have that sort of dreamlike music. And there's only really a couple of snippets when they're suddenly in a car and they turn the radio on and there's suddenly the music he's actually listening to, and suddenly you're chucked back into what's actually happening. And I think the music is crucial for kind of keeping you away.
That's Nicholas Britelli, and it is really wonderful, the music. And it shows, I think Helen and I may have talked about it. Did we do Childhood of a Leader?
Yeah.
Yeah. In how much the gaps in between the music can really benefit the film as well. And I think that's very true of Moonlight, because you've got these little bits of strings and piano, but it's never overbearing at all. It really gives the scene space as well, and it doesn't fill up the scene.
Yeah, because with something like, you know, we did the podcast not long ago about Jackie, and something like that, that purposefully does fill the scenes and fills way too much at points, and that's done intentionally. But this is definitely holds back a bit more, and is definitely a bit more withdrawn with the music.
Yeah. And you said there about giving the scene space, and I think that's something the film does so well, is that each scene is so important to the rest of the film and to showing who these characters are.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you can tell that McCraney has a background in theatre. Now, the treatment he wrote, it was never written as a play. It was always written as a film treatment. And I'm not saying the film is in any way stagey, but that whole thing of you're in this location, use the location, the characters are there, let's have them have the conversation there and stay there. Because often in films, so they'll meet up in a diner and they'll say hello, and the next scene they'll be walking home and the conversation will carry on exactly where they left off in the diner.
Like Aaron Sorkin or something.
Yeah, and it will go then to another location, another location. This film, so two characters meet in a diner, they stay in the diner for, 20 minutes or so and have the conversation there. And there's something so real about that, that they just stay there and the scene's so relaxed and has an amazing pace and just takes its time.
I think the time thing's so crucial for when dramatic events happen. And actually, there aren't too many. There's maybe like one or two big events that kind of shape the way the movie goes and shape the way the characters go. And crucially, that space means that you care about when a big event happens. So something like, you know, when you get an action film and loads of people are, there's loads of, like, you know, explosions and killing and there's action. You don't care about anything. But this film, obviously not being an action film, gives itself space. So when something does happen or a violent act happens, it hits you more as an audience, and therefore you feel it as if the character feels it.
Yeah.
But not just the violent acts. Like, there's some lines of dialogue that completely floored me, and they're just said in this space, in this quiet, and they're not overdone, and it's not, you know, like we said, with this big backing soundtrack, and they're not overacted in any way. And there's some that I won't say because it will sort of spoil parts of it, but there's some that they're delivered and you could almost miss them.
Yeah.
And then I sort of catch myself and realise what they've said, and I was absolutely floored by it.
Yeah.
And I do think the writing is outstanding. And I just wanted to mention the original title. I think that's an incredible title. In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue.
Yeah,
it's a real sort of evocative statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just shows
what, like that's a couple of words.
Yeah.
And titles are hard.
Yeah.
And they've just completely nailed it. I'm so, like, this film is incredible.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, there was talk about August Wilson.
Yeah.
And actually, Viola Davis, when she won her award at the SAGA Awards, she said,
SAGA.
SAG. Sorry.
Yeah. The SAGA Awards for, like, 50-plus insurance.
All right.
I mean, Viola Davis does love, like, a cruise ship, and she loves car insurance. Free pens. So it makes sense.
Viola Davis, during the SAG Awards, when she won, said about August Wilson, said, he honoured the average man who happened to be a man of colour. And I think this film does that as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting statement. I think that really works for this.
Yeah.
In terms of the drug dealer not just being a drug dealer, the mum on drugs not just being a drug head or whatever. You know, I think that's crucial.
In the discussion that I had with Grant on the Fences one earlier this week, we talked about the fact that in Fences, the trailer and almost the first few parts of the film almost trick you into thinking, oh, this is a film about racism, and that's what this is about. So it kind of hooks you in that, and then it's like, and then it leads you into, oh, this is a film about people, and that's actually what it is, and we can look at that, and then we can dissect what it means at the end of it, rather than using that just the idea of talking about racism as an issue as the thing to hook you in.
Yeah.
And Moonlight does the very same thing. This is a very personal film, and it uses that as a platform.
Yeah, and I think that's really nice to see that they're now ordinary stories are being told. And, yeah. You know, that's what I really loved about... I always mention Amorosity whenever I'm on it. But that's what I really liked about United Kingdom, because initially it was about race and then it became about politics and became about ordinary life. And I think that's where a story's really strong at the moment, and that seems to be where stories about race seems to be going, which is really nice because it means that we're getting a wider array of stories, we're getting different stories and we're getting ordinary stories, and that's really crucial.
Yeah.
I think you're sort of reading around this, there's been quite a lot of discussion about how important this film is in terms of the political climate in America, and obviously we've got things like the homophobic attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando.
Yeah.
And yes, it is important, but I completely agree with you. I think this film is a great film whenever it comes out.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like it's not using the political, it's not being divisive, it's not using the political climate as well. It's just an excellent film, and this will still be an excellent film in years to come when hopefully these issues aren't, you know, we're not living in the climate that we are now, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's outstanding.
Yeah, and that's what Terrell said in the interview. Like, to paraphrase here, you know, it's kind of it's not there for you as a token film. It's not there for the Oscar race to fill a gap that they missed last year. It's genuinely the best way they could tell this story that he knew so well, because it was his life, and Barry, everyone there just put their effort into making this film. And it is amazing that it's got given this huge reaction. I mean, it was the best reviewed film last year.
Wow.
And because there's a website I go on that it sort of gets the because the critical top tens of each critic at the end of the year, and like compiles them into one big list, and this was on most critics number one spots.
Wow. I'll just steal something from Helen O'Hara on another film podcast. What? really lovely described this as, this is not a take your medicine type film in terms of having to learn a lesson or something.
Yeah,
you don't you don't need to force feed this to people.
Totally.
It's a lot of it is a really like easy watch, and I don't mean that as a bad thing, but as in because the music's not harsh, and because it's really nicely paced, a lot of it is like easy to watch and easy to absorb.
Yeah,
and that's why when there are moments that aren't and that are much harsher,
yeah,
that's why they're really crucial.
And there are a number of dream sequences in the film, but because the film is already so dreamlike,
yeah, it's hard
you don't
to,
even
yeah.
know that they're happening. it's just so woozy, and you drift into the film, don't you? And you just let it happen in front of you, and the music and the beautiful, beautiful colours of it, just create this meditation,
yeah,
and this state where this could be 3 hours, 4 hours long, and I could still just happily let this be happening in front of me.
Yeah, I think one of the standout scenes when he's being taught to swim by Juan, and I think you do kind of feel like you are floating there with them throughout the whole film, like you're just there, so sort of relaxed and letting all of these things wash over you. And letting them happen in front of you.
And this is a cinema film.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Oh, totally.
But it's never like flashing and banging in front of you to tell you it's a cinema film. This is not La La Land. Not that that's a bad thing about La La Land at all. But this is a very different thing. But you want that experience as well, where you can be completely enveloped by it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I just wanted to pick up on Naomi Harris, because I know that I've reading interviews with her in the past and stuff. She went to Oxford or Cambridge. She went to one of the two. She said she felt so displaced and so not part of the whole Oxbridge thing. And I think you can see she's drawn upon her own experiences when you watch her in this film. And I'm not saying it's the same thing as being on drugs and struggling with addiction. But I think her performance is exceptional, and I think the fact she's in all three parts and no one else is,
yeah,
and you see her in every part, and they age her really well, that you believe it. I think it's such a shame that she's not being talked about as winning awards, because I think she's there, and I think she's possibly done enough to at least be mentioned.
She's
more.
Nominated, I think.
I know, but there's not this hype around her,
no.
and I And I think she's a really great actress. I think hopefully we'll see her do a big British film, because I know she's in Bond.
Yeah.
But
not much.
But
not enough.
Not enough. Mm. And she's one of the best things in the modern Bonds, as far as I can tell it, because she's flipped a role that had massive issues with it. Moneypenny is a difficult role in modern times because it doesn't work, and she flipped that and made it into her own thing. And I think hopefully she gets a big role soon somewhere in British cinema, because that would be great to see her lead a film and really tackle it and take it on.
Yeah, and she did all her scenes in 3 days while on break from Spectre.
That's amazing.
So, absolutely incredible. Yeah. There's something else I wanted to compare it to, actually, which is Steve Jobs, in that you're telling the story of someone's life in three acts. Did that work for you, the three-act structure, like separating it so, like, exclusively, this is part one, this is part two, this is part three? Did that work for everyone, or would you have maybe rather it been a bit more fluid?
I think it gives the director and writer a level of control by having it in three parts, and I think it really works for me. The reason I love Jobs is it doesn't tell you all the middle bits, and this doesn't tell you all the middle bits, and actually it means that you feel like every scene, as previously mentioned, is crucial and is important, and the dialogue's important, and we're not sat there. You know, some biopics or some, you know, biopics typically show life stories. You feel like, well, why have I been told that? Like, just because that happened in that person's life, is that making a difference to the film? And this felt like everything made a difference to ultimately where the film ends.
I like the three-act structure, and I love Steve Jobs, but I think, annoyingly, it does then make you think, which is your favourite?
Yeah.
Which is the best bit? Or which is the worst bit? And or which is the worst performance? And I do gravitate towards the first third and the last third.
I
think I agree with that. Interesting.
The middle is so
Sanders.
The middle is so formative to everything.
Yeah, and the middle section has a standout scene, but I think it's just the stuff in the school and having a bully and that environment. It just felt like that didn't feel as new, like in terms.
Yeah,
of, whereas there was moments in the first one and there are moments in the third one where I just felt like this is something that I have never seen, and I didn't quite. Although there is, as I said, there is a portion in the middle which is astonishing, and maybe the best scene in the entire film. It's just I just wasn't as attached to that middle section I was to the first and the third, because there's stuff that we can't really say. But there was just some little loss of connection for me in that middle section.
Yeah, if any of them are going to be something I have seen before, it's parts of the middle section, because the first one, that's where you meet some of these characters and really ground yourself in this world you haven't necessarily seen before. And then the middle section is still an amazing piece of work, but there are just parts of it that I think are, you know, how many times have we seen the bullied teenager?
Yeah, and a fight in a school, or someone telling someone to hit someone.
See, I felt like, yes, we'd seen them before, but it felt new to me watching it. Like, there's a scene when he's walking along down the corridor at the school and all the students are walking past it, and we've seen that so many times, but it hit me afresh. And like, I think that was the cinematography and the performance by Ashton Sanders, who I think is really, really good, and he doesn't say much. That's kind of his character in that, but there is so much going on, and you can tell that he has this struggle inside him, but it's so nuanced, his performance.
I think there are also beautiful moments during that middle section. There's a lovely conversation sort of in a corridor, or in between some stairs or something like that, and that, for me, moments like that, there's a conversation that changes exactly how the film is going to go where it's going to go.
Those are the great bits in that middle section, those personal bits just between two people. And there's also a lovely bit where you see him charging through doors, and you just see loads of doors open in quick succession. And that scene is great for building momentum and trying to figure out what's going on. And that was another excellent bit from this. And in the performance, the Ashton Sanders performance in that moment. We won't say what it is, but that's excellent and a really gratifying moment as well.
Yeah. Okay, so if you haven't seen the film, then what are you doing? Go do so now. It's the best reviewed film of last year. We all absolutely loved it, so please check it out in the cinema, the biggest screen you can, because it is a real immersive experience that requires your complete attention. We're going to go into spoiler territory now and discuss the ends of each part of the film. So here we go. I really missed Mahershala Ali when he wasn't on screen.
Yeah.
But I think... Yeah. You are definitely supposed to, because he's such a major part of Chiron's life and such a huge influence on who he becomes that he misses him as well. And I think in the way that he is killed off screen very unceremoniously, I think is so impactful in the long run.
I think that's why he has to go.
Yeah, definitely.
Because of the impact and because he ends up becoming him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't have two of them
in the same world, in the
same life. So therefore that's where he has to go. But I think it's lovely how they don't show you a gang killing or him getting in trouble with
the They don't even show the funeral.
No.
Yeah.
They don't even mention that he's dead. They just say, I haven't seen you since the funeral.
Yeah.
They don't say anything else really about Juan, which I think is so, so delicate.
And I think it gives the character of Teresa more agency to become this mother figure that he's looking for. And I think she wouldn't necessarily become this big figure that we think of in the film without him going.
And the fact that nothing is said, I feel like, mimics Chiron's...
Yeah, he wouldn't say anything.
I can imagine he wouldn't say anything about it.
Yeah. Talking about Chiron not saying anything, although he does have dialogue in the film, you almost feel like he hasn't said anything the entire film, which then there's a moment in Kevin's kitchen in the last few minutes where he says something, like the weight of that, and it almost feels like even in the audience you've just been piling on these layers and layers, and in that moment it all just peels away and all those frustrations, because you have that from the very, very start. And because he's a child, you can't get annoyed with him or frustrated with him for not talking, because some kids don't do that. And Juan isn't annoyed with him either. He's very friendly with him. He said, if you don't want to talk, that's fine. Don't worry about it. But I'm going to make you some dinner or something. And you do have those silences throughout, which then, it's cliche, but they become so loud. And in that little moment at the end, it's just wonderful.
Well, that's why the diner scene just before that's so crucial, because it piles on that pressure even more by taking its time and being slow and you not really knowing where it's gonna go, and that's what makes that end scene, is having that diner scene before it.
And I love the fact that by the end he has become this sort of different person, Black, that Kevin used to give him the nickname of, and he's kind of kept that on, and he's kind of combined the influences of Kevin and Juan into this third persona. I thought that was really nicely handled as well.
But still crucially has elements from his other personas, or however.
There's a moment in the diet, because he's got gold fronted teeth as well, and then obviously he takes them out to eat, and there's a moment where Kevin says to him as he's walking past, he's like, why have you got those fronts? And I think that sums up the whole film. It's an
traps.
Incredible line. Why have you got those? That's it.
Okay, so let's wrap up there. So another huge thank you to CSR for letting us use their studio once again. And now it's time for our Curzon Home Cinema recommendations of the week. Helen, let's start with you.
Duke of Burgundy is on there, which is directed by Peter Strickland.
Love is Strange is also on there. Alfred Molina, John Lithgow, sort of a couple that are displaced from their home, and how they deal with that and how they sort of build on their relationship and work out where their relationship's going and things like that. It's beautiful and lovely filmmaking.
Yeah, I'll go with John Crowley's Brooklyn, which is one of my favourite films of last year. Just about an young Irish immigrant moving to Brooklyn in the 1950s, and the struggles of kind of homesickness and guilt and Catholicism. Wonderful stuff.
Excellent. I'm going to recommend Tangerine. This was a very, very low budget film about two transgender sex workers on Christmas Eve walking around LA, trying to find the pimp who broke one of their hearts. It's a really unconventional film. It's all shot on an iPhone, but really, really fun. Amazing characters, and just shows what you can do with a minimal budget and an iPhone. Loved it. And it's an alternative Christmas film as well. So thank you very much for listening. It's goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Harry.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me, and we'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.